You're listening to The Hour of the Time. I'm your host, William Cooper. Folks, you're going to hear a presentation entitled New World Disorder, written, performed, and produced by Roy J. Giampalli, originally for KMUD, Redwood Community Radio.
New World Disorder. Today, American and world economies find themselves in decline. What has led to this international financial crisis we find ourselves? On January 10, 1993, International Monetary Fund, IMF, Senior Public Affairs Officer Jorge V. Ordonez spoke at Humboldt State University on the IMF and Third World Debt. This investigator asked how the systematic looting of America's savings and loans, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, BCCI scandal, and the Banca Nacional del Lavoro, BNL fiasco, aka Iraqgate, and the Bush administration illegal arming of Saddam Hussein has impacted on the IMF and Third World Debt. The IMF's Ordonez stonewalled the question by responding that, quote, there are some issues that some countries don't want us to discuss, unquote. In other words, yes, the SNLs, BCCI, and BNL are partially responsible for creating international economic chaos. Stan Strachan, editor and publisher of National Mortgage News on one aspect of this multifaceted debacle, and Pete Bruton tying the SNLs to CIA covert operations.
CIA involvement in failed SNLs and how the CIA used the SNL system to launder money that they were sending down to the Contras and sending elsewhere in the world, I think is one of the great journalistic jobs of the last decade. There's been a lot of people who have said the Bruton stuff was imaginary or exaggerated. I don't think it was exaggerated at all. I think the congressional findings on those stories were a joke. They asked the head of the CIA, did you do anything wrong? And he said no, and they said, thank you very much, you're excused. And I mean, that to me is not a congressional investigation. That's a congressional whitewash.
Turning to Mother Jones Magazine, September, October, 92, and George Bush Jr.'s connections through the ownership of Harkin Energy. Harkin went public and made a $25 million stock offering in 1987, which was underwritten by a Little Rock, Arkansas brokerage house, Stevens Inc., which placed the Harkin stock offering with a London subsidiary of Union Bank, a bank that had surfaced in the scandal that resulted in the downfall of the Australian Labor government in 1976 and later in the Nugan Hand Bank scandal. It was also Union Bank, according to congressional hearings on international money laundering, that helped the now notorious BCCI skirt Panamanian money laundering laws by Ferdinand Marcos to stash 325 tons of Philippine gold around the world. Stevens Inc. also helped introduce the BCCI virus into U.S. banking in 1978 when it arranged the sale of Burt Blance's National Bank of Georgia to BCCI frontman Dave Perone. The head of Jackson Inc., Jackson Stevens, was a member of President Bush's exclusive 100 team, or Team 100, a group of 249 wealthy individuals who have contributed at least $100,000 each to the GOP's presidential campaign committee. Jackson Stevens also funneled BCCI funds to Hillary Rodham Clinton's Arkansas law firm. Now can be seen how these power brokers play both ends of the street. 4+ years ago, Washington withheld the truth about the savings and loan crisis until after the November elections. Now experts fear the same thing may be going on with the nation's banks. This from the San Francisco Examiner, This World, 8/30/92 story, December Surprise. The delay in closing insolvent SNLs before 1989 accounted for $66 billion of the estimated final tab of $2 trillion. We now know how the cover-up happened in 1988 when the regulators hid the SNL debacle. That year, the chief culprit was Federal Home Loan Bank Board Chairman M. Danny Wall. Wall frantically sold off 220 SNLs under the Southwest Plan. Tim Anderson of Nacon Banking Consultants says,
M. Danny Wall was 100 times more powerful than Alan North ever was. M. Danny Wall continuously lied to Congress on how bad the issue was. But they could never go after M. Danny Wall because before M. Danny Wall became chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, he was a senior staff member of the Senate Banking Committee. He basically was Jake Garn's speechwriter out of Jake Garn's office and a member of the Senate Banking Committee. So the chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board was a former Senate staffer. That's a pretty good jump in your job description. But he knew way too much on many senators, much more than just the Keating Five. So a deal was cut in August that M. Danny Wall, who had failed miserably as chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board, would be rewarded by being the chairman of the new surviving agency, the succeeding agency. The Federal Home Bank Board was being dissolved, and the officer of supervision would be the new agency.
Returning to the 8/30/92 Examiner, and this time around, the administration's point man was Timothy Ryan, who was appointed director of the Treasury Department's Office of Thrift Supervision in 1990. Ryan began his career in politics working for CREEP, the Republican Party's campaign to re-elect the president in 1972. So Ryan being a Nixon crony does not bode well. If the SNL debacle taught us any lesson, it is this. Delay in the takeover of an ailing bank often adds substantially to the ultimate cost. When the Bank of New England, which regulators kept open in 1991, long after it had become insolvent, the delay swelled the bailout cost to $2.5 billion. As an indirect result of the financial shenanigans, since July 1990, 476,000 New England jobs have been eliminated. That's 30% of the nation's total workforce, according to the Wall Street Journal. From the information presented so far, it can be seen how the insiders abuse the process. But what underlying theme allows the unbridled control of our laws, and how is this accomplished? A number of books and authors point to bankers, industrialists, and politicians as being responsible. Eustace Mullins, in A Study of the Federal Reserve, states that economic manipulation of our financial institutions can be traced back to last century. Mullins points out the origin as London, 1869, when Anthony Drexel and J.P. Morgan made a deal with Europe's N.M. Rothschild to control U.S. banking.
Hello, folks. This is William Cooper for Swiss America Trading. As you know, a fire has caused us to move from WWCR to WRNO. When our friends at Swiss America Trading heard about the fire, they went right to work finding us another place to broadcast. And just within a matter of hours, this new station was found, thus making it possible for this program to continue to get the truth out to the world. The people at Swiss America Trading stand behind this program, and I would like for you to stand behind them. Swiss America Trading deals in protecting their clients through non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets. Now, you heard me inform you about the trouble this country is in, both politically and financially. And, folks, the time to act is now. Call the experts at Swiss America Trading at 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. And have them show you how to protect yourself. Call 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. Mention my name, William Cooper, for a free newsletter on protecting your future. By protecting your future, you're keeping the future of this program and freedom for the world alive. Call today, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did.
Artificially created money panics or depressionary cycles resulted. The reason for this secretive agreement was that the Rothschilds had plans to manipulate U.S. fiscal markets and make a monetary killing. Because of the establishment of the independent sub-treasury system, later to become the U.S. Federal Reserve, these cycles were created in 1873, 1893, and 1907, causing widespread suffering and arousing the public to demand that Congress enact legislation to prevent the recurrence. Since our initial financial debacles, we have experienced the Great Depression of the 1930s, fiscal downturns of the early 1960s, 1972 to 75, and the late 1970s into the beginning of the 80s. Financial journalist William Grider, author of Secrets of the Temple, How the Federal Reserve Runs the Country, and Who Will Tell the People, states in the 10/29/92 Rolling Stone that our current economic situation is akin to the 1930s Depression. William Grider.
Somewhere in the book, Preston Martin, who was then vice chairman of the Federal Reserve Board under Paul Volcker, complains, and it's really a lament, the Fed is throwing the savings and loans to the wolves. And what he meant was, and this is in the mid-80s, what he meant was that relentlessly high interest rate, which the Fed held year after year, long after the recession of the early 80s, was the central engine bankrupting the S&Ls. And it's true, that's not the only reason they were in trouble. They made a lot of bad loans and they did a lot of hustling and so forth. But people want to see this as a few Texas, California crooks who got clever. And yes, there are always Texas, California crooks, but the main engine was the economic conditions of the 1980s. Which inflated the cost of credit, and without any regulatory controls over what these institutions could commit themselves to, you know, when you're going down the tubes and you figure, hey, I'm already insolvent, why not roll the dice again?
Even the establishment San Francisco Examiner, in a January 10, 1993 article, contrasts our current financial dilemma to the Great Depression and shows pictures of U.S. soup lines and a British hunger march. And according to author Robert Chamberlain in his book, The 1990s Decade of the Depression, banks and S&Ls will continue to fail with, quote, the nation's largest and most prestigious banks being counted among the likely candidates, unquote. Both Chamberlain and author Guy Daniels in The Long Wave Cycle cite the research of Russian economist Nikolai Kondratiev. Kondratiev found throughout the history of capitalism, there were periods of economic expansions, quote, followed by severe economic contractions, which lasted for 10 to 15 years, unquote. February World Press Review cites 2,000 layoffs at Sanyo, 3,000 at British Aerospace, 10,500 at Mercedes-Benz, 16,000 at Michelin, 40,000 plus at IBM, 70,000 at General Motors. These are industrialized nations where huge corporations are eliminating jobs. What's behind this massive waste of the human worker? Three immensely powerful parallel organizations can be directly linked. They are the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, the Bilderberg Group, and the Trilateral Commission. CFR was founded in 1921 after the U.S. rejected the League of Nations. Its founders included J.P. Morgan, John D. Rockefeller, Paul Warburg, Edward M. House, Jacob Schiff, and Otto Kahn. According to the book, Ending the Deception, CFR was founded for the purpose of controlling American foreign policy for the benefit of the international bankers. Since then, their goals have magnified considerably. Quote, the goal is to create a new world order or world socialist superstate, unquote, i.e., a totalitarian fascist regime. In 1954, the first Bilderberg Group conference was held in The Hague, Netherlands, with strict secrecy and security. Its aim is to influence national policies and international affairs. Then, in 1972, the Trilateral Commission was founded by David Rockefeller. The conservative Spotlight newspaper says that, quote, trilateralism is an offshoot of Bilderbergism and world dominance via global financial manipulation. Control the world leaders in the interest of power, profits, and greed, unquote, are the goals. Who are these power brokers that control the world? By perusing the CFR June 1990 annual report, many past and present power mongers can be discerned. The list reads like the who's who of the war hawks, influence peddlers, and disinformation disseminators. David Rockefeller, former chairman, Chase Manhattan Bank and CFR, and currently Trilateral Commission chair. Robert S. McNamara, former World Bank President and U.S. Secretary of Defense. Dwayne O. Andrus, former U.S. Interior Director and Chair, CEO, Archer Daniels Midland Company. Anthony M. Solomon, Chairman, S.G. Warburg Inc. and former President, New York Federal Reserve Bank. William H. Donaldson, Chairman, New York Stock Exchange. George M. Keller, Chairman and CEO, Chevron Corporation. Thomas V. Jones, Chairman and CEO, Northrop Corporation. Peter R. Kahn, CEO, Dow Jones Corporation. Mortimer B. Zuckerman, owner, publisher of U.S. News and World Report, New York Daily News, and Atlantic Magazine. Paul A. Volcker, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, and current Federal Reserve Board Chair Alan Greenspan are among the most prominent persons topping the CFR economics list. Inside job author Stephen Pizzo on Alan Greenspan.
It was 1986, and we had owned Lincoln Savings for only about a year, but already federal regulators were very worried about what they saw happening over there, and they had made complaints to Congress, and Charlie had complained to Congress as well, but complained about federal regulators harassing him and putting unreasonable demands on him and such. And all they were really demanding he do was follow the few remaining rules that existed in the fifth industry, but he didn't even want to do that. So there were hearings of the House Banking Committee, and Alan Greenspan came and testified on behalf of Charles Keating. He was under Charles Keating's employ at the time. Keating had hired him as a consultant for him, and he had written a letter to Congress and had also written a letter to Ed Gray, who was the chairman of the Federal Home Loan Bank, the chief S&L regulator for the country at the time, saying basically, you know, the trouble with you, Ed, is you worry too much. Everything's fine at Lincoln. It's one of the best shops in the country, and it's the future for this industry. And he said the biggest mistake we could make right now would be to begin withdrawing the deregulated powers and to re-regulate the industry. And he went on to name 17 S&Ls in his letter to Ed Gray that were doing just great right now around the country. Vernon Savings, he named a number of them, specifically named them. Today, every single one of those on Alan Greenspan's list is out of business, and the cumulative losses between all of them is up in the double-digit billions. So this is the man who's now running the Federal Reserve System as a whole and is now, as you mentioned, deregulating banks by regulatory fiat, basically because Congress has flatly refused to do it. Take over, take over. I'll take you here.
William Grider on the Federal Reserve from Secrets of the Temple. Quote, the Fed was the operating center for a mysterious network of unseen but awesomely powerful people who were manipulating the society for their own purposes, world domination. In the 1970s, as inflation accelerated, the dark theories about the Fed thrived anew. Disseminated in scores of homemade newsletters and privately published books, when Paul Volcker was confirmed by the Senate Banking Committee in August 1979, a citizens group from Virginia had testified against him, noting his connections with the top-secret Bilderberg Conference, David Rockefeller's Chase Manhattan Bank, CFR, and the Trilateral Commission, all of them staples in the popular theories of one-world conspiracy, unquote. Other prominent CFR governmental types are Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State and Chairman Kissinger Associates, Lawrence Eagleburger, President Kissinger Associates and outgoing Bush Secretary of State, Brent Scowcroft, Deputy Chairman Kissinger and Associates and Bush National Security Council Advisor, Dick Thornburgh, former Bush Attorney General, who resigned because of complicity in the alleged murder of investigative journalist Danny Casolaro, involved in the Inslaw Promise investigation tying it to BCCI and the October Surprise. More on that later. Richard Cheney, Bush Secretary of Defense, William Webster, former FBI and CIA Director, Frank Carlucci, Reagan's Secretary of Defense, Richard Darman, former Office of Management and Budget and Budget Director, Howard H. Baker, Jr., former U.S. Senator and Reagan's White House Chief of Staff, former CIA Directors Richard Helms and Robert M. Gates. Gates is an alleged member of the October Surprise Group flown to France for the Napa Sentinel, which included then VP candidate George Bush in 1980. On the lengthy CFR membership list are former Presidents Richard M. Nixon, Gerald R. Ford, Jimmy Carter, George Bush, and the 42nd President of America, Bill Clinton. Now that President Clinton's true allegiance is known, his key appointments' CFR affiliations should also be spelled out. Warren M. Christopher, Secretary of State. Leslie Aspin, Jr., Secretary of Defense. Anthony Lake, National Security Advisor. R. James Woolsey, Director of Central Intelligence, and lawyer for Israeli disinformation specialist Michael Ledeen. Madeleine Albright, UN Ambassador. Bruce Babbitt, Secretary of Interior. Donna Shalala, Health and Human Services Secretary. Samuel Berger, Deputy National Security Advisor. And Vernon E. Jordan, Jr., Super Lawyer Lobbyist and unofficial D.C. Ambassador to the power elite and on 11 corporate boards, are all card-carrying CFR members. Clinton's other CFR membership installees continues and is much too lengthy for this framework to delineate. Recall that the Council on Foreign Relations objective is to create a one-world super-socialist state. Their credo, New World Order, or as this documentary is titled, New World Disorder. Another Clinton VIP nominated to a critical post is former Senator and 1988 Vice Presidential candidate Lloyd Bentsen, the co-owner of three failed thrifts that cost taxpayers billions, with a B, of dollars. Pete Bruton in The Mafia, CIA, and George Bush underscores Benson's importance to the powers that be. According to the investigative work of Bruton, he ties Benson to known CIA Mafia frontman and Houston developer Walter Mischer.
Mishra's CIA mafia connections go back to the 1950s, and his buying land in Belize to use for staging in the U.S. overthrow of Guatemala's legally elected government headed by Jacobo Arbenz. Because of massive amounts of conflict of interest and the stonewalling of his and his partner's Gregory Shea's stories, Bruton left the Houston Post. Representing the Post and Walter Mishra both simultaneously was Fulbright and Jaworski. Jaworski is the same Leon Jaworski who did damage control in Watergate, who could have tied Richard M. Nixon to the JFK assassination. Pete Bruton.
Jaworski obviously had to know about the MD Anderson Foundation laundering money for the CIA. Just Fulbright Jaworski ran the MD Anderson Foundation. So he was probably involved, without doubt, in laundering money for the CIA, helping them. And I have people tell me that they believe that Jaworski had other connections to the CIA. In other words, he represented them in legal matters. And so here we have the same old story. Someone tied in the CIA being brought in to head or lead an investigation that touches on the CIA. And you know, the CIA never got really tied in to Watergate. Now Nixon, you know, tried to threaten the CIA to get them to call off the FBI investigation. And you know, one of the things he threatened them with, he said, you know, this whole Howard Hunt Cuban thing could come out. And there's a lot of speculation, it still is, about what exactly did he mean by that. And some people think he was talking about the CIA hiring the mafia to kill Castro. And, you know, that, if that came out, that's something that just is outrageous. I mean, an agency of this government hiring organized criminals to do things. And, of course, that came out during the search committee.
And these names came up again in your book.
The disinformation continues to emanate from the establishment. In the February 2, 1993 Village Voice, Frank Snepp, allegedly a former CIA agent, tries finally to put to rest the October surprise story in his disinformation piece entitled Last Rites. And in the March issue of the conservative American Spectator magazine, pro-Israeli author Stephen Emerson also lambasts the concept that Bush, William Casey, Donald Gregg, Jennifer Fitzgerald, and Robert Gates flew to La Bourget airfield outside Paris, where intensive meetings with Iranians took place, resulting in the continued holding of Tehran American Embassy hostages until the Reagan-Bush inauguration. Emerson tries to place William Casey during preliminary Madrid-Spain July meetings at the Bohemian Grove Resort on the 25th to the 27th of that month. However, Fooling America author Robert Perry, writing in the February 22, 1993 Nation, details how concrete evidence and testimony precludes Casey from being there during the end of July of 1980. Perry also details, through various interviews and sources, how Casey participated in the October 18th and 19th, 1980 France negotiations, resulting in the Reagan-Bush ticket stealing the November election. In other words, treason. Besides the March American Spectator piece by Emerson, it carries another disinformation story by Israeli mouthpiece Michael Ledeen. Ledeen denounces Iran-Contra independent counsel Lawrence Walsh in his investigation. However, if one were to believe Emerson and Ledeen, the following logic would be valid. Since the October surprise never happened, neither then did the Iran-Contra affair. Despite these efforts at damage control, it's a fact that Iran-Contra happened. In addition, interviews by this investigator with numerous individuals, including first October surprise author Barbara Honegger, the Iran-Contra affair was a direct result of the October surprise negotiations. Now that logic tracks.
We've got to take a break, folks. Don't go away. I'll be back after this very short pause. Hello, folks. This is William Cooper for Swiss America Trading Corporation. If you followed my broadcast for any length of time, you know I've been bringing you news of the world without sponsorship. In part, I've been leery of allowing just any corporation to buy time on my show. I'm proud now to announce a new alliance. Swiss America Trading Corporation and myself are committed to preparing my listening audience for the upcoming economic trauma, and you can rest assured that it is coming. For over 11 years, Swiss America has been supplying over 10,000 clients with hard assets and constant information on how best to protect those assets. For a limited time, interested listeners can receive a complimentary newsletter if you mention my name, William Cooper, and ask for the information on, quote, protecting your future, unquote. Call 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646 today, right now, and invest the time it takes to read one of the most important publications of our times. Call 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad that you did.
After all, that's been covered. Since Bill Clinton is the latest power broker in line, it appears that the establishment of an independent counsel is out of the question. Why? January, February, Mother Jones details in the piece Shredded Justice. Before leaving office, the Bush administration Department of Justice went on a wholesale destruction of incriminating evidence files in the Inslaw affair, their BCCI-CIA involvement, and the BNL Iraqgate fiasco implicating the stonewalling former attorneys general Edwin Meese, Dick Thornburgh, and William Barr. If a proper and thorough investigation were enacted, the domino effect of guilt would result in not only the conviction on treason and more of George Herbert Walker Bush, but Ronald Reagan, Gerald R. Ford, and Richard M. Nixon would all have to be prosecuted for crimes against the Constitution and the country. There was the 1992 Christmas Eve blanket pardoning of culpable Iran-Contra figures by Bush to try and cover his tracks. Former officer of Naval Intelligence and author of Behold a Pale Horse, William Cooper, on George Bush's participation in international drug running.
Bush has, every time any legitimate investigation into the source of drugs has been conducted, George Bush's name has emerged during the investigation. And every time they get to a certain point where they're just about ready to open up the whole can of worms, somebody from a security agency steps in and smacks the veil of national security down over the investigation and tells them that they cannot proceed any further because they're jeopardizing the national security of the United States and that it will reveal sources of valuable information to the intelligence community and could cause the death of those sources, which is all total bullshit. Not only is the CIA involved in international drug running, money laundering, and arms dealing in this hemisphere, it appears it has spread to vast areas in Africa, Western and Eastern Europe as well since the fall of communism. This is in addition to what Alfred W. McCoy documents in The Politics of Heroin, CIA complicity in the international drug trade, and the agency's role in the Golden Triangle. The San Francisco Chronicle ran a two-part story, December 17th and 18th of 92, on the depth of the illicit activities. The feature's two-day spread, entitled
drug rings thrives as Europe opens international borders and drug trade feeds world's rebellions. The articles detail the breadth of worldwide heroin and cocaine smuggling, money laundering, and the arms dealing network. It's a truly disgusting scenario, and the implications are far-reaching. So we have the world being engulfed in never-ending war or low-intensity conflicts in conjunction with financial manipulation and the widening of the international drug scourge. Returning to the financial front, critical portions of our economic situation are federal budget deficits and federal debt. A basic way to explain the concepts was detailed in a February 7, 1993 San Francisco Examiner article, simply stated, the federal deficit is the annual difference between what the government takes in, mainly from taxes, and what it spends. The federal debt is the sum of all annual federal deficits. Historically, for William Grider in Secrets of the Temple, quote, in 1945, following the massive deficit spending of World War II, the national debt was 119% of the annual gross national product. But the burden was shrinking dramatically as the post-war economy expanded robustly. By 1960, the debt was only 58% of the GNP. By 1969, it had fallen to 40%. In 1974, it was down to 35% of the nation's economic output. Then the historic trend was reversed. In 1975, for the first time since World War II, the national debt did not decline in relation to the economy. The new trend was mild at first, not nearly as dramatic as the debt generated in wartime, but an odd turn of events would aggravate it. A conservative government would assume power in the 1980s, and instead of moderating the fiscal imbalance as conservative governments were expected to do, it accelerated the trend. The government accumulated deficits much larger than before, and the national debt grew much faster than the economy. By 1984, the debt ratio would rise from a low of 35% to about 45% of the GNP, back above the level achieved in 1969. The government's balance sheet, in other words, began to resemble the fiscal conditions normally tolerated only during a war. Unquote. Additionally, according to Robert Chamberlain, by the end of the last decade, our national net debt was greater than the combined debts of the next three largest debtor nations together. President Clinton proposes increasing taxes while cutting expenditures in an effort to spend our way out of this financial malaise. However, both political economic camps see problems with this prognosis. Heritage Foundation experts say tax increases will destroy jobs, undermine international competitiveness, reduce economic growth, and increase the budget deficit. The National Bureau of Economic Research conducted sophisticated comparisons across countries and found that high taxes retards growth rates. Poor countries with bloated public sectors are much more likely to stay poor than those with streamlined bureaucracies and low tax rates. Another very important component in our global marketplace is NAFTA, North American Free Trade Agreement, and GATT, General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. NAFTA has been attacked by U.S. and Canadians alike for the exporting of high-paying, skilled jobs to third-world countries which pay lower wages, have less stringent environmental regulations, and produce higher profits for multinational corporations. NAFTA will undermine higher education, increase unemployment rates, and erode the tax base. Quote, funding for education is already dwindling. With NAFTA, the federal government will be permanently trading away its ability to fund education, unquote. GATT has some very ominous and secretive international negotiations. Herbert Gunther, Executive Director,
of the Public Media Center on GATT.
Essentially, the global projection of America's 12-year nightmare. If to put it on a global scale, what's taken place in America in the last 12 years. The background, 108 nations after the war, 1947, they get together in Havana, Cuba, and decide that as we come out of World War II, we need a set of basic rules to govern international trade. And out of that, treaty was drafted, which governed nearly everything. But interestingly enough, even though it was a conference attended by 108 nations, the debate that took place was between representatives from the State Department, the U.S. State Department, and representatives of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. They had a fundamentally opposing worldview. The State Department wanted no barriers to international trade because they thought trade and diplomacy went hand in hand, and the fewer barriers, the better. The Department of Agriculture understood that family farmers survive in America for a simple reason, that the cost of growing food is never equal to what the price of the marketplace is, that there's something weird about economics that doesn't, in fact, pay a farmer what it's worth, or what the value of growing food is worth, and that America's agricultural subsidy programs and also trade protection programs, we don't let in certain products, agricultural products, to protect the agricultural markets that are here. That needed to be reflected in any kind of international treaty governing trade. So the result was that they really didn't come to an agreement other than to say that they wouldn't deal with agriculture as part of GATT. They would treat it under separate agreements that would be worked out between countries.
The March 1st, 1993 Nation magazine forecasts a dark shadow. Quote, the weaknesses in the current economy far outpace the strengths. And unless President Clinton quickly adopts unconventional solutions to our chronic economic problems, his administration, like the Bush, Carter, and Ford administrations before it, is doomed to fail conventionally, unquote. Where's our positive indicators? What should be done? Roger Peace, author of A Just and Lasting Peace, The U.S. Peace Movement from the Cold War to Desert Storm, has some viable suggestions in this time of international constricting economies and workforce reductions. He addresses how not only is the civilian sector in dire straits, but that the world militaries are contracting as well. Roger Peace offers these ideas. How and where will tens of thousands of unemployed military personnel and military industrial workers be employed? What consumer goods can be profitably produced by transformed military industries? How can the economy be redirected to meet human needs? The cause of unmet needs lies in the nature of the capitalist economic system, designed primarily for corporate profitability. Meeting human needs and developing a viable economic structure in the U.S. will require a fundamental restructuring of the economic system. Economic planning, designing the economy to meet human needs and protect the environment. Democratic accountability, an end to monopoly capitalism. Redistribution of income and wealth, progressive taxation and higher minimum wages. Guaranteed economic rights for all citizens, employment, housing, health care, education, and income security. Facilitating the conversion of military industries to peaceful uses is unlikely to occur without structural changes in the economic system. Given a world market already saturated with industrial goods, very few military industries will be able to convert to civilian production, particularly in recessionary times. Military industries will thus try to maintain jobs and profits by increasing arms sales abroad and fighting harder for government contracts. Local workers and communities will try to hold on to military industries and bases unless there is a realistic plan that will generate employment at a livable wage. Military industry workers face the same essential problem as workers involved in cutting down precious forests or exporting toxic chemicals.
Fear of unemployment compels them to disregard the common good. The issue of economic conversion thus needs to be approached from the point of view of economic rights, particularly the right of full employment at a livable wage, and comprehensive economic planning. Without comprehensive planning, it is likely that elite decision makers will turn peace conversion efforts into taxpayer subsidies for corporations and S&L bailout for military industries. The international capitalist system is a monopoly game in which those who have much win more, while those who have little lose what they have. The peace movement should aim for discrediting the U.S. world policeman role as we move into the 21st century. As to human rights, the peace movement needs to push for the adoption of a consistent standard of human rights applied to all countries, whether considered allies or not. And finally, peace activists and organizations need to function as a movement connected by common goals, strategies, structures, and actions.
And the beat goes on. Hello, folks. This is William Cooper for Swiss America Trading. As you know, a fire, WWCR, burned to the ground. This fire has caused us to move. And when our friends at Swiss America Trading heard about the fire, they went right to work finding us another place to broadcast. Within just a matter of hours, a new station was found, thus making it possible for this program to continue to get the truth out to the world. The people at Swiss America Trading stand behind this program, and folks, I want you to stand behind them. Swiss America Trading deals in protecting their clients through non-confiscatable, non-reportable hard assets and many other types of investments, many of which I have recommended on this program and others that I don't know anything about. Now, you've heard me inform you about the trouble this country is in, both politically and financially. The time to act, folks, is now, not later, but now. Call the experts at Swiss America Trading at 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. And have them show you how to protect yourself. Call 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. And mention my name, William Cooper, for a free newsletter on protecting your future. By protecting your future, you're keeping the future of this program and freedom for the world alive. Call right now, today. Don't procrastinate. Call right now, 1-800-289-2646. That's 1-800-289-2646. You'll be glad you did. Good news, folks. All the CADGI memberships, domestic and foreign, are in the mail. Every single membership that we've received is in the mail at this time. Watch your mailbox. Now, because of our hard disk crash, some of you who have already received your press credentials are going to get a duplicate set. Just send them back to us, telling us that you've already received your press credentials and don't worry about anything. We'll get it straightened out. with your help. Just thought you'd like to know that, folks. Tonight's broadcast was entitled New World Disorder. It was written, performed, and produced by CAGI member Roy J. Giampalli, originally for KMUD, Redwood, California Community Radio. I hope that you enjoyed the program. Now remember our admonition to our listeners. It is absolutely imperative, folks, that you do not believe what you hear on this broadcast, what you hear from Tom Valentine, from Chuck Harder, from Dan Rather, from Ted Koppel, from the man with half his brain tied behind his back, or indeed even from your own mother. You must begin a campaign of research on your own. The world is so full of misinformation, disinformation, lies, accidental information, and every other kind of thing that you can think of that you cannot afford to believe what anyone says. Not me, not anyone. It is important that you verify everything that you hear on this program or any other program through your own hard work, your own efforts. Now, if you're going to tell me that you don't have the time to do that, then I'm going to tell you that if you depend on someone else to tell you what is right and wrong, what is true or false, then all of your life you're going to be nothing but a puppet on the end of someone's string. And when the puppet master pulls the string, you will dance, and you will dance to the tune that is played, and you will dance in the direction that you are told to go. For that is the nature of sheeple. Not people, folks, sheeple. Real, intelligent people investigate everything. They believe nothing. They listen to everybody. They evaluate. They sift. They weigh. They're always searching for the truth. The truth is elusive at best. And those who do not bother to determine what is true and false through their own efforts are sheeple. Sheeple, human sheep. Remember, sheep are always sheared and are always eventually led to the slaughter. I sincerely hope that those of you listening to this broadcast do not fit into that category. However, way down deep inside, I know beyond any shadow of a doubt that most of you do. Most of you. Now, one way to tell if you're a sheeple or a people is when I tell you these things, if it makes you angry, then you are a sheeple without any doubt whatsoever. For real people know who they are. And if they're not a sheeple, they know that I am not talking to them. And thus, what I say does not make them angry. So, folks, I hope you've enjoyed tonight's broadcast. To all of you out there, I sincerely hope you wake up. Because of what's happened in Waco, Texas, I know that the United States is no more. The Constitution is nothing. And we've got to either change that or accept the New World Order. So until next time, folks, good night, and God bless you all.
This ain't coming from no prophet, just an ordinary man. When I close my eyes, I see the way this world shall be. Here we go walking in it. When lies, for his words that he said, when that shelter over the forest haze, we shall be free. The last thing we notice is the color of skin, and the first thing we look for is the beauty within, when the skies and the oceans are blue again. We shall be free. We shall be free. We shall be free. And train walk round. We shall be free. Anyone we choose, when this world's big enough for all it can do, we all can worship from our own kind of views, we shall be free, yeah. We shall be free. We shall be free. Have a little faith. And then morning calls for the very last time, and nobody will hold the stair behind. The man only wants the last man's time. We shall be free. We shall be free. We shall be free. And pray, have a little faith. Oh, yeah. We shall be free. We shall be free. We shall be free.